A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Live from the BBC, The Naked Scientists.
Hello, welcome to this week's edition of The Naked Scientists with me, Chris Smith, and also with Helen Scales.
Hi, Chris.
This week, how to combat collisions. Yes, scientists are looking at the insect world for the solution to road rage and all kinds of crashes on Britain's roads. How are we going to make them safer? Well, it turns out that insects have their very own ability to avoid bumping into things, and scientists now reckon they can borrow from biology and apply that to cars, to make them less able to crash into each other too. We'll be finding out how this evening. Also on tonight's show, social insects, how ants, wasps and bees live together and interact together. How does that relationship come about? How do they help each other? And is it just ants, wasps and bees? Or are we on the trail of finding other kinds of social insects lurking out there somewhere in the wilds of Thailand? We'll be finding out from William Foster from Cambridge University this evening. And also, bioluminescence. If you don't know what that means, you must have heard of glowworms and fireflies. How do they make that animal light? That's the amazing chemical findings that we're going to be looking into later on this evening with someone from the University of Cardiff. He's coming on the phone. And also, have you ever been stung by a jellyfish? Tell us, what was it like? And did you get someone to wee on you to make it better? We'll be discussing whether or not that's actually the best thing to do. Hello, my name's Chris Smith, and also here, as I say, is Helen. What else have you got in store for us, Helen?
Yes, well, of course, as every week, we will give you a rundown of the latest news in the world of science and technology and medicine. And so this week, we shall be finding out what knit nurses found when they rummaged through the heads of thousands of school kids in Wales. So I'm not quite sure if that's going to be very nice, but very relevant for the insect theme we have today. And also, we will be learning about a fungus that might help eat through the tons and tons of plastic waste that we throw away every year. And also, on an environmental note, we'll be hearing about how the US has just created the world's largest marine protected area.
And if you're in an experimental mood, don't forget, because it is National Insect Week this week, we've been asking you to go out into your garden and set some pitfall traps. No, they're not the kind of things that are 6 feet deep with sharp bamboo spikes at the bottom to catch your dad. These are not man traps, they're pitfall traps. You just put a plastic cup into the ground, cover it with a bit of wood or something, and see which drops in overnight. Have you been doing this? Have you caught anything interesting? We want to know about it.
The Naked Scientist Podcast, brought to you by thenakedscientist.com.
Now, as we always do on the Sunday evening, we're going to take a look at what's been happening this week in the world of science all over the world. And a very encouraging piece of news has come out from the University of Wisconsin, where Adam Guss and his colleagues have found an exciting way to break down things called phenolic resins. Now, you may not have heard of phenolic resins, but these are actually very bad for the environment because they're heavy-duty plastics. They're the kind of thing that makes your car's air filter, the air conditioning unit, in other words, heavy industrial or automobile parts, the car trim, that kind of stuff. And to give you an example of how much of a problem this is, they're accumulating in landfill sites in America, for which I know the figures, to the tune of 2.5 million tons of these things every single year, and they just don't break down. And the reason that people thought they were very durable and robust is because you make them by taking phenol, which is disinfectant, most people have heard of that, and you boil it up with something called formalin, the stuff you use to fix and embalm bodies. And when you do that, the two things link together in a dense meshwork of fibres, which nature and natural processes find it very hard to pick apart because these things are locked together so tightly. But what Adam Guss and his team noticed over in the University of Wisconsin was that if you look at this stuff very, very closely, it's very similar in terms of its ultrastructure to lignin. And lignin is the woody bit of plants. And fungi love lignin. It's one of their preferred food choices. So why not try and see if various types of fungus could break down this stuff? So what they did was to select a panel of 11 different types of fungus, including one type that are called white rot fungus. And in fact, they found one of them. It's called Phanera keati cryosporium. And this fungus breaks down, they found, this phenolic resin, this heavy-duty plastic that we previously thought was not biodegradable. So that's really encouraging, because what it suggests is that actually what we thought was a problem for the environment may actually not be so if we can work out how to make these fungi even better at eating the stuff. Helen.
And that sounds like great news, especially as we have so much problems with where to put all our waste. And the sea is one place that people seem to think might be somewhere to put all those plastics that can't biodegrade, but very bad idea. And yes, this week we've had really exciting news in the marine biology world that George W. Bush has made quite a shock announcement that he has created and will be creating the world's largest marine sanctuary in Hawaii. Basically, the plan is to designate an area of 340,000 square kilometres in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands as a national monument. And this is the highest protection status that the US can have. And it will completely ban all fishing activity in the area. And it's a really important area for the oceans there. It's one of the most pristine areas. They think there's around 7,000 species of marine fish and invertebrates there. And around a quarter of those we don't find anywhere else on the planet. But Chris, do you know which country the Americans have now beaten to the post of having the biggest marine protected area?
Well, it's not going to be Japan, that's for sure.
No, definitely
not. Or Scandinavia.
No, definitely not.
Go for South America.
No, it's the Australians, the Great Barrier Reef. That used to be the world's largest marine reserve. But now the Hawaiian Islands beat them to that. And there's one main difference, actually, between this new protected area in Hawaii and the Australian Great Barrier Reef, in that these Hawaiian Islands are extremely remote and uninhabited, virtually uninhabited. There used to be a US Navy base out there, I think, but that's not really got any people left on it. So really, there isn't that much of a conflict anyway going on between people. There's only about 8 fishing boats that were ever allowed to operate in the area, which is a huge contrast to Australia, where the Queensland coast is hugely populated, there's enormous industries, the tourism industry, there is some fishing still allowed inside the Great Barrier Reef and marine sanctuary. It's sort of zoned into different things that you can do. So in a way, maybe it's an easy option just to say, oh, we're going to cordon off this bit of Hawaii, does it make any difference? But conservationists do think that could have become, there could have been more development basically moving into these islands and that fisheries could have started expanding. So it's really preempting that kind of impact, which is really quite forward thinking, especially coming from the likes of George W. Bush, who hasn't necessarily got the best reputation when it comes to things like wanting to go and search for oil and gas in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in
Alaska. It's quite interesting, Helen, that I remember you writing an article to highlight the fact that often there are unforeseen benefits to man's activities. And in fact, the Kennedy Space Center, where all the space shuttles blast off from, has actually had a major impact on fishing. To the benefit of fishermen locally.
That's right. I mean, just because we had to keep people out of that area because there were spaceships going off and people weren't allowed to fish, it basically meant that the fisheries around there, outside of that area that was protected, were becoming prize-winning and enormous, and the fishermen were pulling out these enormous specimens, and it was doing a great thing. So, you know, cordon off one piece of the oceans and it does actually spill out and really boost fisheries as well as, you know, biodiversity elsewhere as well.
Because the key thing here, that probably the mistake that a lot of people make, is you end up catching the big fish, and this means the small ones slip through the net, obviously. And a lot of people think, well, that's good, you leave the small ones to grow big, but actually the big ones have the most babies and have the fittest offspring.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, we're kind of putting almost an evolutionary force on these fish stocks, and we're causing them to actually change to become smaller because those are the ones that aren't getting caught. So it's like a natural selection force going on there. We really are making huge changes that we just don't quite understand, and whether or not the fishes will actually recover after we stop fishing them is another question.
But we're sticking with this sort of marine theme. I've got an email here from Mike, who's actually he's studying ecology in Utah in the US. And he says, I'm an ecology PhD student and I listen to your podcast in Utah. I've got a question because in a recent show you talked, in fact Helen was talking about the speed of a jellyfish sting. There's a myth, or is it truth, I've heard, that urine from a human can negate a jellyfish sting. Is that an urban legend?
Right, I've been looking into this because there doesn't seem to be a very clear answer as to whether or not actually urine does help with jellyfish stings or not. I mean, what we're trying to do here, what the idea of putting something onto a jellyfish sting after you have been stung is A, to kind of reduce the pain, because obviously you've already been stung and that hurts a lot.
Have you ever been stung?
Yes, quite a lot. Of course, marine biologists get stung all the time. It's just part of the job.
Come on, what's stung you?
Come at various things that I haven't seen, but just kind of grabbed at my ankles when I've been walking through shallow water, and one wrapped itself around my leg and had a lovely line for a while, a nice scar.
So what did it feel like for you?
Burning and just very, very painful.
Was it like an electric jolt, literally instant agony?
It felt like a really bad stinging nettle sting. In fact, one time I felt like I'd stepped over a stinging nettle, but a really horrible stinging nettle, basically. Mm. I mean, friends of mine have been stung by stingrays, and that's really nasty.
Oh, really?
That you sort of, if you step on one by mistake and it flips its tail around and jabs the sting into your leg, now that's really nasty.
I got stung by a Portuguese man of war. That was actually when I was swimming off of Palm Beach in Florida, not far from the Kennedy Space Center, in fact, near your marine reserve. And that was very painful.
Those are very dangerous, those ones.
In Australia, they call them blue bottles. And yes, a really interesting bit of trivia about this, since we're talking about jellyfish, and I'm sorry to interrupt and steal your thing about stings, but a really interesting thing about jellyfish and Portuguese man of war, you know they're sort of a mobile float. They look a bit like a breast bobbing along on top of the water. And on the top of this bubble, let's say, they have this sail of tissue sticking upwards. And it's interesting because different versions of the jellyfish have it pointing at different angles. And half of them have it pointing, let's say, at 45 degrees, and the other one have it pointing at 135 degrees. So the idea here is that when the wind's blowing onshore, half of them will blow out to sea and half of them will blow onto the beach. So you only lose half your population at any given time. Isn't that amazing?
That's amazing. And you know that actually Portuguese man of war aren't jellyfish. They're actually a type of hydroid.
Sort of colony.
A colonial of lots of little tiny cells that stick together and act and create. I think a silicon implant was a nice way of describing the float in a Portuguese man of war.
I like my analogy better. But sorry, carry on with what you're saying
anyway,
about sting.
So we don't know about the effect of urine. And what you want to do is get rid of the pain, but also try and stop. If you've got a tentacle stuck to you, try and prevent any more of those nematocysts, those firing little blast that I was talking about the other week, try and stop them from firing. And I was looking around and I couldn't find any scientific studies that would be prepared to look at why urine might have an effect on this. It certainly is something of a traditional treatment in lots of different parts of the world. It's something that people do. It's something you've got access to, let's say, if you have a sting and you don't have with you some vinegar, which vinegar is much more a usual sort of treatment for jellyfish stings and has been tested. In fact, there was a study in that was reported in New Scientist a few years ago saying that they tested coke and Coca-Cola, sorry.
Because cocaine would be excellent, because cocaine's a fantastic local anaesthetic. It's a really good local anaesthetic, so it would work.
So if you don't have any of that, Coca-Cola and four-day-old wine, but basically because they're very acidic, can help reduce the pain and stop the firing of these nematocysts. And we think it might be something to do with the vinegar dehydrating these nematocyst cells and sort of stopping them being able to fire. But it's a bit hazy still. So if all you've got is urine, it might work. And apparently males have more sterile urine than females. So if you get a male friend to provide the necessary for you, then that's great. But if you can't, you know, bring some vinegar along just in case, it's probably better.
Okay. Well, here's a hair-raising story, because we are talking, obviously, about insects this evening because it is National Insect Week. And a recent study amongst Welsh school children, researchers have published this in the Journal of the Archives of Disease in Childhood. They actually went to and tested 300,000 school children in 31 schools across Wales, and they got 316 lice samples after combing their way through these 300,000 heads. And they tested these lice against the usual chemicals that were used to clean heads that are infested with nits. And these include things like permethrin and malathione. They're the usual creams and lotions you rub in. And worryingly, 80% of the nits that they recovered were resistant to these permethrins. So what we've got is a rising tide of resistance. We've seen this with superbugs in hospital. Now we're seeing the same thing with nits on people's heads in Wales. I wonder if it's going to spread to elsewhere in the UK. I hope not. Itchy, itchy, itchy.
The Naked Scientists. Supported by the Wellcome Trust.
Time now to head across the Atlantic and join the guys at Science Update, Chelsea Wald and Bob Hershon.
For the Naked Scientists this week, how being overweight might actually be healthy, at least if you're pushing 80. But first, to the prospective mothers out there, do you wish you could make like Angelina Jolie and run off to a resort to relax for the duration of your pregnancy? Well, of course you do. But if you can't afford it, take heart. Chelsea explains that your baby may not mind a little stress.
In fact, a little stress during pregnancy may even be helpful to the baby. This according to Johns Hopkins University developmental psychologist Janet DiPietro. She and her colleagues found that when mothers experienced mild stress and anxiety in mid-pregnancy, their kids had superior mental and motor skills by age 2, whether or not mom was still anxious. And the kids were just as well adjusted as others their age.
There were no effects on how children behaved. So it's not that they were doing better developmentally, but they were really a handful to control. There was no effect on things like how hyperactive they were, how they control their emotions, and so on.
She cautions that it's still important to treat severe anxiety or depression, but everyday stress may be nothing to stress about.
Thanks, Chelsea. Well, if you live to be 80, you're entitled to carry a few extra pounds. In fact, it may be healthy to do so. This according to University of Southern California epidemiologist Maria Carrada. She and her colleagues found that people in their 80s and 90s who were somewhat overweight, according to the commonly accepted body mass index, actually lived longer than their leaner counterparts. Just why that is isn't clear.
Maybe having a few extra pounds may protect the elderly from more severe injuries such as hip fractures, for example, during a fall. There's some diseases that are associated with weight loss, and maybe having a few extra pounds means that you can lose a little bit more weight before you become too thin and too unhealthy.
Whatever the reason, she says that different weight standards may be needed for the oldest of the old.
Thanks, Bob. Next week, we'll talk about scientists who are listening to animals like horses and killer whales. Until then, I'm Chelsea Wald.
And I'm Bob Hirshon for AAAS, the Science Society. Over to you, naked scientists.
That was Chelsea Wald and Bob Hirshon from Science Update. More details on their website at www.scienceupdate.com. Now, as always, we're going to do a bit of kitchen science this week, and we're off to the Museum of Zoology in Cambridge, where Derek's with Sam, Luke and Dr. Ed Turner from Cambridge University and the Wildlife Trust, and they're going to be making some pitfall traps that I told you about earlier. Hello, Derek.
Hello there, and this week we've come to the Museum of Zoology in the University of Cambridge for National Insect Week, and of course we are now in National Insect Week, so we're all very excited about the science experiment that we're going to do this week, because we are going to be catching insects, and we're doing this with the help of one chap who's come to help us out. Would you please introduce yourself for us?
Hi, my name's Ed Turner. I work at the Zoology Department here in Cambridge and also with the Wildlife Trusts.
Okay, and I gather you've set up some experiments for us to catch some insects, is that right?
Yes, what we've done is we've set up some pitfall traps here to catch some insects.
Fantastic. OK, and we've also got some volunteers who've come along to help us out. So, guys, could you give me your names, your first names, and what school you're from?
Hi, I'm Sam from the Purse.
I'm Luke, also from the Purse.
OK, and it's National Insect Week, so are you guys excited? Do you like insects?
I've loved them since I was very, very little.
OK, that's absolutely fantastic. And yourself?
Yeah, I like insects too.
Right then, so, Ed, what we need to know then is how to make these traps so that we can catch some insects, because of course people at home can do this as well, and they've been encouraged to do this over the last week, but if they'd like to listen to your instructions now, they can do it. So, what do you have to do?
Well, it's very, very easy. All you need is some plastic cups, and you just want to find a patch in your garden where you can safely dig, so that's quite important. Don't dig up the middle of your lawn or anything like that. Just dig a small hole, put the cup in, and make sure the surface of it is completely flat with the soil, so any insects walking along can easily move into it. And maybe what you could also do is put half a bucket over the top of it to protect it from the rain.
OK, then. And obviously people might think, oh, I don't really want to cut up my bucket at home. I mean, is there anything else they can use to protect it?
Yeah, absolutely anything. An old ice cream carton, anything like that, really.
And then suspending that above it to above the cup that you've put in the soil to protect it from the rain, how can you do that?
Well, what I've used is some bamboo poles, but you could use any sticks, anything at all, just to hold it off the surface.
OK, then. Now, we're actually in the new museum site at Cambridge, and we've set up some pitfall traps already, but what are the kind of places that we can set them up in to kind of see what different kinds of insects we can get?
Well, what I've done here is I've put some traps in the border, so actually in the loose soil. I've put some also underneath a hedge, and I've put some into the lawn as well. I've had the permission of the gardeners here in zoology, so you could do that if you're very careful, but you have to ask your parents first.
Yes, exactly. So we don't want anyone to be decimating their parents' lovely lawn here.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, you can, a little bit of a hole, not too much, though.
OK, that's fantastic. So just to recap what Ed said there, we've got four pit traps here, actually, in slightly different positions. One of them is on the lawn itself, and then the rest of them are kind of on the soil, kind of in the garden. One of them's in the shade, one of them is quite far away from the border of the lawn, and one of them is very close to that border. So have a go at home. Why not try and find out the different places you can put pit traps and see what you can get? And, of course, Sam and Luke are very keen to know what we've got in these pit traps, but we're not going to find out yet. We're going to find out later in the show. But, Sam, what do you think we might have got in some of these pit traps?
Well, in the lighter ones, you may find smaller insects than in the shade, because the shade gives them more protection.
OK, it sounds like we have an expert speaking here. I think Ed is nodding very impressed over there. And yourself, Luke, what do you think?
We might get some grasshoppers or flies or something.
Okay, and we will see all about that very, very soon. So there we go then. What we've got here is a setup in the new museum site at Cambridge University, which we are going to be looking in later on in the show. But we would encourage you guys at home to have a go at this. And of course, if during the last week you have already been setting up your pit traps, then please tell us what you found. We'd love you to phone us on 08459 25 2000. And of course, you can email as well. That's chris@thenakedscientist.com. And if you're emailing, why not send us a picture? Lots of people have, you know, phone cameras now and stuff. So if you can send a picture of the insects that you've got, send them into The Naked Scientist, that would be absolutely fantastic, all in the name of National Insect Week. So anyway, we will be back here at the University of Cambridge Museum of Zoology very, very soon. Please do join us then. Until then, it's back to the studio.
Thanks, Derek. That's Derek Thorne, who's out there at the Perth School with Sam, Luke and Dr. Ed Turner, and he's from the Wildlife Trust, and we'll be hearing from them later on in the programme. But as he says, if you have any fantastic insect finds in your garden, call in now, 08459 25 2000. You can email chris@nakedscientist.com, or you can send us a text message, 07786 20 1960. I've got a line here from Mike, who says, I'm from Maryville, Tennessee. It's a small town in East Tennessee near the Smoky Mountains. I've enjoyed the show for several months now, and my 12-year-old son heard it today and really enjoyed it and will probably become a regular. So thanks very much for that, Mike.
Now, you might remember last week I talked about we got some emails saying that they loved our English accents listening on the podcast on the internet. And I've got another couple of emails here saying just the same thing. Here is one email from Kelly Topp in Toronto in Canada. She says she loves the show. We get right into the stories without wasting a second. And there are so many podcasts where we have so much chit chat at the start. So I hope you're still enjoying that. And yes, she says as well that she loves our accents. Well, that's very nice to hear indeed. Also hear from Pete in Australia. And I thought Australians, our accents were quite like an English accent, really, weren't they?
But good eye, mate.
Americans,
they're going to hate me for that.
All the Americans listening can let us know. Do you think that it's difficult to tell an English accent from an Australian accent? Because I find I'm always told that I'm Australian by Americans. But Pete from Australia says he particularly likes our accents, especially mine. Thanks, Pete. I'm always told
good fan
I'm
there,
very
Helen,
posh,
yeah.
So that's great to have a fan.
Now, look, you guys, I should say our guest in the studio this week from the University of Newcastle, we have Dr. Claire Rind, and from the University of Cambridge, Dr. William Foster. They're here with us, and you're doing very well because you've already got a surge of emails, you guys. This one you're going to love. It comes from Amber Tremaine, who says, I know this is probably the stupidest question you've ever received, but on average, how many flies do we accidentally eat every single day? Can you get back to me ASAP? Because I really need the answer for something very important. Amber, what do you think, Claire?
Well, I'm not quite sure, but commercial companies have actually quantified the amount of insect material we're allowed to eat in chocolate and cornflakes and things like that, so that if they have to quantify it, you must be eating it.
Because it's insect parts per million in chocolate and things, isn't it?
It is, and I would say that we probably eat more than we would like, and it's just a little bit of extra protein, perhaps.
Because I've got this email here, Chris Demicoli. He says, my name's Chris, I'm from Malta. I'm not sure if you've ever received a mail from a Maltese, but I hope to be the first. I listen to your show through the podcasts. My question is, how do worms appear in things such as packets of nuts when it's still sealed tightly? I've always wondered about this and suspect that it has something to do with expired goods or possibly the temperature. Fantastic show, thanks very much. So presumably it's the same thing.
I was going to say about eating flies. People do catch them in Lake Victoria in huge numbers, lake fly, and I have eaten them. They taste like shrimps, which is rather unexpected.
Just tell us more about this. So what is this?
Well, huge emergences of chironomid flies occur in Africa in Lake Victoria, and people have caught these commercially.
What do they look like?
Well, they're like tiny midges. And they come in huge clouds. It looks as though smoke is rising up over the lake. And
if they're that tiny, how do you even know you're eating them then?
Because they compact them down into small fly cake.
Is that like a Gary Baldy? We used to call those crushed fly biscuits.
It's 100% fly.
But flies are actually quite high in protein, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, they're delicious. Very good for you, I'm sure.
So how did someone discover that? And how do you prepare them? You crush them down and then, what, fry them or just dry them?
I think they were just dried. They just wanted to do something with this huge biomass emerging from the lakes.
I suppose if you're desperate, then you'll eat anything, wouldn't you?
But I think they're quite nice.
Well, what's the funkiest thing you've ever eaten? You've presumably eaten those, but what else, William, have you...
I've had fried termites. They're very delicious. Fried...
Where was that?
In Uganda. Sort of sexual termites emerge in the morning. The children catch them, give them to their parents, and they fry them. When they come home from school at lunchtime, they eat them. And they're very nice.
I was in Beijing, and there's a wonderful market. It's a mile long. You can walk along this street market, and you can have deep-fried cicada on a kebab stick. And they put about 13 cicadas on a kebab stick and deep-fry it. And actually, it's an interesting flavour. I'll say that. You sort of have to crunch through this hard shell, but it's actually quite nice once you get past the revulsion. Come on, Claire, you work on locusts. Have you ever eaten one of those?
No. I've offered them to my colleagues, but I haven't had any takers.
Here's another email for you. This is from Lydia. Lydia is in Austria. She says she's writing to us from Graz in Austria. My father's a great fan of your show, and he's advised me to ask my question of you. Why are insects, which have composite eyes, not blinded by the sun? Apparently they have no eyelids that they can shut, and my friend Vendelin blinded some ants with a laser pen, and it appeared that they were quite irritated by that.
Well, I think they probably were quite irritated, but insects, they could be temporarily blinded by very bright light, but then eventually when they go into the dark again, their photopigment would be regenerated. And there are some ants that live in really bright conditions in the desert, and they would have pigment to protect their sensitive photocells. And in addition to that, all their neural machinery behind their eyes would act to adapt to a very bright light, so that the whole system is geared up to being able to adjust the gain, like you get with a camera. If you point a video camera at a bright scene, you can see that the camera adapts, and that's what eye would do if the insect lived in a very bright condition.
Now, when we say compound eye, actually, I mean, someone made a model of a compound eye. They managed to make an artificial one the other day, which I thought was absolutely incredible, using light burrowing down through a sort of polymer. But how does the insect actually process that? Because it's got tons and tons, probably thousands of images of the world landing at once, hasn't it? I mean, take a lot of processing.
It does take a lot of processing, but that isn't the way the insect looks at it. They don't have thousands of complete images. The whole image of the world is pixelated, really. It's more
sort of
like
broken up over that.
That's right, broken up. And every little lenslet looks out at a particular region in space. And then it just has to put together all the information from that particular region in space. And that is a beautiful, beautifully engineered circuitry. But it's repeated many times over the eye.
Now, Claire, the reason I sort of vying towards vision in insects is because a little bird told me that you actually won an Ig Nobel Prize for showing episodes of Star Wars to locusts. Why?
Well, because I could. No.
Who was funding this research?
The BBSRC. But the Star Wars had a huge array of different visual scenes of looming motion, and that's why we chose Star Wars. And
what do you mean?
The viewers.
What do you mean? Explain that a bit.
Looming is when an object's coming straight for you, straight
like
towards
the viewer.
Like
those big spaceships and things.
Yes, spaceships coming straight for you. And the other thing is that they had spaceships that were passing directly over you. They were coming very close, but they weren't actually having a collision. So we could test the different responses of the neurons to a near collision and a collision.
And this is your locus bump, sort of anti-bumping device.
Yes.
How does that actually work?
Well, it detects objects which are approaching by the way that they expand over the eye. And there are circuitries that extract those image cues and will give a warning when the system detects very rapidly expanding edges, which are features of objects which are approaching and on a collision course.
So how could you apply that to the automobile industry? Because that's obviously the stance you're taking on this.
Well, the way we're applying it is we've got a silicon chip, which is inspired by the insect eye, and it has small photocells, rather like the cells in the insect eye, and then the signals are passed through various layers of circuitry, and eventually, after much computation, the signals are summed up, and a collision warning is issued if there is sufficient evidence for there being an object approaching on a collision course.
But how is this better than the driver at the wheel of a car anyway? Or are you thinking of cars that have now an autopilot of some kind?
They could have an autopilot, but at the moment, a driver is not very good at reacting quickly enough, especially if there's a child or someone steps out quickly in front of the car and the accident is imminent.
Say there's a child steps out, but there's another car coming out of the way. How does your computer resolve that?
The most salient feature, you know, the thing that gives the biggest response is the one that the system would react to.
And so it would hit the kid and ignore the car coming the other way then?
It wouldn't hit the child. It would. That would be the image that was expanding most rapidly over the sensor, and that the collision alerting system would be switched on by that image. It ignores a lot of other movement, you know, like the flow fields that you get when you drive along the road, the images flowing back over the sensor. It ignores all that. It's specifically looking for an object which is on a collision course. And the car coming straight for you, it will be a problem if it's coming straight for you as well.
It's Dr. Claire Ryan from the University of Newcastle-upon-Tyne. If you would like to ask any of us a question about anything science, but remember it is National Insect Week this week, and William Foster's here in the studio too to start taking your questions. 08459 25 2000 is our phone number. You can email me, chris@nakedscientist.com, or you can send us a text on 07786 20 1960. It is, of course, The Naked Scientists with me, Chris Smith, and Helen Scales.
Stripping down science.
Okay, let's do it.
The Naked Scientists.
The Naked Scientists, Chris and Helen, talking this evening with our guests, William Foster and Claire Rind. She's from the Newcastle-upon-Tyne University, and William's from the University of Cambridge. William, got another email here. This is coming from the States. It's from Randall Bachman. I hope I've pronounced your name right, Randall. He lives in Texas, and he says, I appreciate your show. You'll do a great job. Being in the States doesn't afford me much opportunity to listen in live, but I do play along with your quizzes and things. I have a question, because in a recent episode you were discussing bees, and it's well known in the USA that bees are dying. As you can imagine, this has a profound impact on certain kinds of agriculture. Why are these bees dying? Are they dying elsewhere? And can anything be done to stop it? Do you know what's going on in Texas?
Are we talking about honeybees here?
Yeah, I think he's talking about honeybees.
Well, there is this Varroa mite thing, which is rushing through populations of honeybees in Europe. I'm afraid I don't know about the American situation, but this is a very, very serious pest, which is causing a lot of concern, certainly in European hives, and I imagine the same thing is happening in America. I'm afraid they don't know about particularly America.
So what actually is the mite in Europe? Because it probably is analogous.
Well, it gets into the brood, into the sort of cells where the larvae and things are growing, and essentially eats them and kills them, and is very, very contagious, and gets from colony to colony and does a huge amount of damage.
Well, so what do bees normally do to get rid of problems like this? Because obviously bees have been here for a long time, haven't they? And they haven't normally succumbed to this kind of problem. So why has it suddenly appeared now, and how do they normally deal with it?
Well, they normally, they're very hygienic bees. They're very keen to clean up their colonies, and it's very important. It's one of the important tasks of the workers to do that. So they go around taking out dead bees, fungus, and including mites as well. I assume this is a relatively new thing which has come into their system, and they've not yet properly adapted to it.
OK, let's have a quick chat to Colin. Hello, Colin.
Hello.
Good evening. Welcome to The Naked Scientists.
Right.
What have you found?
Well, I found a couple last year dead. They're beetles. They were over an inch long.
Yeah.
The shell was, a withered acorn would be a good description of it.
So it's about an inch long then?
Yes. And I actually saw one, when I was putting the dogs in, they're flown off the window. The wingspan was nigh on 2 inches of this one.
Oh, they have wings?
Yeah.
Okay.
This one was flying. It had wings. And the antenna or whatever, if I said a set of false eyelashes on the end, can you imagine?
God, you're making this quite difficult, Colin. Let's have a see what Claire and William think. What do you reckon?
Well, a beetle with eyelashes on the end is like a scarab beetle or a chafer beetle. It's a very common, they're called, the technical name is lamellicorn beetles, and they use that for picking up pheromones and scents and chemicals and things. So it could be some kind of chafer beetle, a rose chafer or something like that.
Right.
Particularly this time of year.
Have you got access to the internet, Colin?
I have, yes.
I think it's actually, I found this because maybe these guys can help me, because I put a garden pond in recently and I bought some lilies and they were looking gorgeous until all of a sudden the leaves started appearing like someone had been taking little bites out of them. And when I got one of these leaves that was being devoured at a fast rate of knots, it's a tiny caterpillary-like thing that actually gets between the upper and lower surface of the leaf and eats its way in and out of that, and apparently it's a midge. And by looking on the net, Colin, I managed to find pictures that were directly the same as this thing that I was finding in my pond and get an identity on it, and then you can find out how to actually deal with it. But maybe it might be worth having a look at, say, Google Images or something.
Yeah, so, but you think it sounds like a chafer beetle, does it?
Yes, possibly, yes.
Yeah, well, that gives me a starting point.
Quick go at the quiz, Colin.
Go on.
Because up for grabs tonight, there's a year's membership to Bug Life, and in fact we'll be talking to Matt Shardlow shortly from Bug Life. And also, courtesy of William, you can have a tour around the secret stores at the Museum of Zoology. What's that all about, William? What have you got on offer there?
Well, most of the Museum of Zoology is not on display to the public. So all the kind of beetles and indeed vertebrates and mollusks and Darwin's barnacles, for example, are on able to be shown behind, but you need someone to
Sounds
show you
rude.
Around.
Sounds rude, Darwin's barnacles.
Darwin's barnacles are lovely. They're all on slides.
What are they?
Well, he spent, after he came back from the voyage to the Beagle, he spent about, I don't know, 8 years turning himself into a proper biologist by becoming a barnacle taxonomist. And he discovered the barnacle, a lot about the barnacle life cycle as well as how to identify them. And we have the actual, or a lot of the actual specimens that he worked on.
OK, Colin, here you go. Belches from farmyard animals are causing the greenhouse effect. Do you think that's science fact or science fiction?
It's fact.
Yep, that's right. Those flatulent farmyard animals account for 20% of the global emissions of greenhouse gas methane.
And if they come round my house, they'll find another competitor to that. It's not me. You can smell a giraffe from up to a quarter of a kilometre away. Do you think that's fact or fiction?
Fiction.
I'm afraid it's actually true. Apparently those stinky giraffes have two chemicals in their fur called indole and 3-methyl-indole, which help repel ticks and prevent bacterial and fungal infections.
2 out of 3 so far, Colin. Last question. Over half of monkeys have evidence of broken bones caused by falling out of trees. Do you think that they're just careless monkeys or that's a porky?
Fact.
Yep, that's right. Apparently Japanese study researchers have found that lots of these macaques have actually fallen out of trees, and it's probably not because they're fighting each other, but they really just aren't very good at those acrobatics.
Well done, Colin.
2 out of 3, so that's not bad.
Right.
Take care now. Thanks for calling up.
Thank you.
Good luck with your bug hunting.
Thank you. Bye.
It's the Naked Scientists, Chris and Helen. If you have an interesting bug you'd like us to identify, you have a question about anything science, but with a slant this evening towards insects, then text, call or email those numbers, 08459 25 2000, text 07786 20 1960 or email chris@nakedscientist.com.
Fancy listening to the Naked Scientists in your bed, on your way to work or even at work? Why not subscribe to our podcast? For more information, visit nakedscientist.com/podcast.
So, William, we mentioned at the beginning that one of your interests is in social animals, and you're going to be going off to the Back of Beyond to Thailand soon. Why is that, and what are you going to find there?
Well, we're hoping to look for social behaviour in beetles. Now, social behaviour is very important in insects because the most successful animals in the world, all animals, are ants and termites. And they're successful because they're social, because they're able to have huge colonies very well organised. Now, this has evolved rather infrequently. It only occurs in ants, bees, wasps and termites. And we'd like to be able to see whether or not the largest group of animals in the world, the beetles, whether any of them are social. And there's a particular group of beetles. They're called, I'm afraid they don't have an English name, really. They're called Passalid beetles. The Americans call them Bess beetles. Now, they have quite advanced parental care. That is, the parents look after their young, and they do things like help the larvae make the pupal case around them. They can't do it themselves. The parents have to kind of push from one side, and the larvae push from the other side. So they have very elaborate social care. And this has been known for a while. But no one's ever really studied them very thoroughly. And we know there are large colonies of various species in this part of Southeast Asia, and we want to go and find them.
So when you're mounting an expedition like that, how do you set it all up? What's the steps involved, and obviously, how much is this going to cost?
Well, it doesn't cost all that much. We're doing this with the Natural History Museum in London, and they are mainly going to collect and look for beetles and Lepidoptera, butterflies and moths in the area generally. And they've done most of the organisation. What is really required is a permit to bring the material out of Thailand, because all countries, quite correctly, don't like people just going in and sort of pillaging all their animals. They want to know what's happening. And this, we haven't got the permit yet, actually. We're still, the National Museum is still negotiating with the Thai authorities, but we will have that. That's the major thing that's needed. Otherwise, you just need somewhere to live, and nets and tubes and alcohol, that is 80% alcohol.
Not for the scientists.
No, we never drink that kind of thing. In which to put the insects when we caught them.
So, going back to these beetles, do we think that the origin of this social behaviour, wasps live together in colonies, we think that some spiders do, ants definitely do and bees do, of course, Do they all have a sort of common ancestor that developed like that, or have they independently evolved to have this interreliance and interdependence on each other?
It's happened independently several times, but not that often. The termites probably had two origins of social behaviour. For example, the ants probably only one. Another group that is social are the aphids, greenfly, which I've worked on a little bit. There, you would expect them to be social because they're colonial, they're clonal, they're all the same genetically. So just like if you still have that breast in your mind, the Portuguese man of war, that's also a social animal. It's clonal, it's identical, only some of the individuals in the Portuguese man of war actually reproduce.
And it's the same for green flies, is it? Some of them sexually... So yes. Rather than just cloning themselves, they will actually have sex.
Well, only some of them actually reproduce. Some of them are totally sterile.
Well, greenfly, this
yes,
is not Portuguese.
This is greenfly.
Yeah.
Some of them are just warriors, like there are warrior polyps, warrior individuals in the Portuguese.
Is that to distract predators? So if you've got 50 billion greenflies, a couple of them don't actually do anything. They just sit there as a greenfly eating and looking fat and juicy. Then if something comes along to eat the greenfly, it's more likely to pick on one of those ones that's sterile, that's not going to reproduce, and leave alone the one that can foster another
set of... In this case, it's more the fact that there are soldiers, which are baby ones, heavily armed with teeth and so on, and then claws, and they rush around over the colony, kicking off parasitic wasps or anything that's trying to come and eat them.
There's an interesting story recently where scientists were looking at how plants actually have their own sort of alert system, where they use chemical signals so that when, say, a caterpillar or one of these other green flies and other kinds of animals eats the plant releases various chemicals that then attract predators that like to eat the animals that are eating the plant.
Yes, they attract, not predators, they attract parasites.
Yes, sure.
So they're usually Hymenoptera, like the ants, bees and wasps, but in this case not social. They come flying in and lay their eggs on the caterpillars that are eating the plant. It's a relatively recent discovery, but it's definitely true. There's lots of good evidence for this now.
So going back to your Thailand situation, why is it that no one's ever discovered the fact that there are these social beetles knocking around, given the wealth of information you've already told us, that these things have these interdependent relationships on each other? They can't reproduce without another one's help.
Well, people have studied them a little bit. There's some work been done in America. An American schoolteacher in the 1930s kept them by his bed and watched them doing various things. I suppose there's not much money in them. They're not that important ecologically. They are quite important, I think. They live in wood and break down wood. And no one's really been that interested in this kind of theory of the evolution of social behaviour until recently. So it's something we want to look at.
Isn't there a claim that... In fact, in the same way that Claire's trying to look at locusts to see if there are ways in which we can borrow from biology to make cars safer, people are interested in looking at how ants communicate and signals pass through colonies in order to make computers faster.
Yes, indeed. I think there are lots of analogies one can make with social insect colonies and how to make sort of, as it were, things like brains work or how to make complex systems work, because all these colonies work on very simple rules which the individuals make. And by the accumulation of lots of simple rules and lots of individuals, one can get the emergence of very complex properties. So I think that's the kind of approach that people are taking.
Going back to your expedition, when you're out there, presumably it's rainforest you're looking at, is it? And you're hunting down these beetles. How will you know if they are social rather than just being a whole bunch of beetles that happen to live in high concentrations? What's the kind of keys you're going to be looking for, do you think?
The key thing in the end we want to see, and this will involve, I'm afraid, killing them, is to the extent to which the females in particular in there are reproductive. So if we got, say, 100 females, and they are recorded to be 100 in one log, we would, as it were, collect them all and see if there's a queen beetle who is full of eggs and so on, and lots of worker beetles who aren't. So we're looking for the extent to which reproduction is concentrated in one individual rather than spread across the whole colony. No one knows that at all for this group at the moment.
The Naked Scientists, Chris and Helen, and we're talking this evening with Dr. Claire Rind and Dr. William Foster. If you'd like to ask them any questions, 08459 25 2000 is our phone number. You can email us, chris@nakedscientists.com, or send us a text. It's 07786 20 1960. Anything to do with the science of insects. And keep your calls coming in. More questions coming up in a second, including do ants go to sleep, William? That's coming up. And also why mosquito bites are itchy.
Laying the facts bare. Ooh. The Naked Scientists.
Okay, got an email here from Brian Orr, who's in Singapore. Hello, this is Brian from Singapore. I'm just wondering, when I was walking home the other night, that I saw a bunch of ants that were crowding around some food crumbs on the pavement. Do ants sleep? What's going on? They seem to be running around all the time. Do they have some kind of shift schedule that they follow, one on, one off?
Yes, someone has looked at ants' behaviour patterns by following the behaviour of the whole colony over a matter of days, and they have very definite patterns when the whole colony kind of closes down. They just all rest there, and then a few hours later they all start moving around again. Then in a very specific rhythm they all stop again. So they do have rhythms of behaviour. Whether they're exactly sleeping, they're certainly kind of resting. They're not active all the time.
If you have a question like that, the more the merrier and the funnier the better, I guess. Just email them in chris@nakedscientist.com. Now, Matt Shardlow's on the line. He's the Conservation Director of Bug Life. Good evening, Matt. Thank you for joining us.
Evening.
Tell us a little bit about your work.
We're a little charity called Bug Life, and we were set up 4 years ago to fill the gap in the conservation agenda where there hasn't been an organisation about promoting the conservation of all British invertebrates, of which there are 44,000. Incredibly important little animals doing all sorts of jobs like pollinating flowers, keeping wildlife alive. They're eaten by birds and fish. Without the invertebrates, which are the little cogs that make the planet go round, all the other wildlife would be in trouble. So we've been set up as a new charity to try to address some of the conservation issues that are specific to invertebrates.
You very kindly offered to give a year's membership to someone who wins our competition this evening. What will that entitle them to? What will they get?
As a member, obviously, you're part of Bug Life. You're supporting the work that we're doing, making sure that there's more invertebrates out there. And I think we'll talk a bit about some of the problems that invertebrates are facing in a little while. And you'll also get, obviously, our updates, which will put you right up on the ball as to what's going on with invertebrate conservation, and posters when they come out, and all the various other access to our website, etc.
Now, one of the things that you're looking at, Matt, is brownfield sites. In other words, you know, sites that people have built on, they've become derelict. They're important for these kind of animals, allegedly.
Yeah, absolutely. Brownfield sites are actually as important for endangered invertebrates as ancient woodlands are. So we think of some of these natural sites as being, you know, very natural, very untouched by human hands, being very important for wildlife. But actually some of the sites that we've been mucking around with most also actually very important for types of wildlife. So for instance, old sand quarries where we've dug the ground out, there's open bare sand. In some cases, like the Thames Gateway, where these sorts of sites are close to the sea, close to where there used to be an upper salt marsh, which was also a dynamic sandy habitat, you've got species now living in the brownfield sites, in these old sand pits, that previously you would have found along the tops of the salt marsh. But, of course, the salt marsh is now all covered with sea defences, so there's nowhere left for these animals to live. However, these brownfield sites have a lot of other features that are important for wildlife, important for invertebrates to survive.
It's quite ironic, isn't it, Matt, that we've created an area of human habitation and therefore a niche for these animals, and we might end up having to conserve areas of the countryside that we've actually initially damaged in order to save these species.
Yeah, we tend to think of green fields as being sort of analogous with, you know, wildlife-rich, a wonderful haven and Eden type of thing. But if you actually look at what falls into the formal classification of a green field, it also unfortunately includes lots of, you know, what a brown arable fields that are sprayed repeatedly by pesticides and herbicides, and even most of the pastures out there now have very few wild flowers left in them. They're covered in fertilizers, that's bad for the invertebrates. They're sprayed with pesticides, that's bad for the plants and the invertebrates. So in terms of, you know, a rich ecosystem, these rich ecosystems are now actually increasingly rare. And what is happening is that a lot of the places where you are getting lots of wild flowers, so there's lots of nectar and pollen sources, but also lots of bare ground for things to nest in and bask on, which lots of these invertebrates love to do.
What sort of animals are we talking about here, Matt?
Wasps, beetles, bees, butterflies, things like the dingy skipper, for instance. There's a little salt marsh beetle that's called the salt marsh short spur, little ground beetle, for instance, that you get in the Thames Gateway running around on these sites. Also bumblebees. You know, bumblebees need these large areas to go and forage and get all their nectar from so they can get the next generation of queens out for the next year. Without these areas of brownfield, there would be much smaller nectar resources for a lot of these bees, and they'd be going extinct. In fact, they're already declining massively. So things like the straw cardabee and brown banded cardabee disappeared from wide areas of the countryside, hanging on, for instance, in the Thames Gateway, on these large brownfield sites which still have wild flowers on them.
They all sound fantastic. They're all these bugs that we can find. What do people who live nearby think about these insects? Are they aware of them, or is this sort of, are they kind of hidden away and we don't really see them?
I think they're becoming more aware of them, and again, that's, you know, one of the things why bug life was set up. Bugs get a lot of bad PR, and they get a lot of mosquitoes out to get you, and new invasive alien invertebrate out to destroy the countryside. Aphids about to eat all your garden plants, but very rarely does anyone.
So I can identify with that.
Well, exactly, and you know, I'm not saying that doesn't happen, but at the same time, no one's out there sort of saying, look, these bees, they pollinate our crops. 2 out of every 3 mouthfuls of food that we eat is there because of pollination. And 80% of the crops that are grown in Europe are pollinated by invertebrates. And if we're looking at an environment that's sustainable, if we're looking, forward, just on this one issue of pollination, I could pull out any number of other ones, then we want to sustain our populations of pollinators, because who knows what we're going to be trying to plant and grow in this country in 100 or 200 or 1,000 years' time to feed our children and our grandchildren.
So they're going to do a pretty good job, aren't they? Look, Matt, we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you for joining us and telling us about the importance of this, and thank you for donating a year's membership to Bug Life to a successful winner on The Naked Scientist tonight.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. That's Matt Shardlow, who's the Conservation Director of Bug Life, and this is The Naked Scientist.
Stripping down science.
OK, let's do it.
The Naked Scientists.
Chris and Helen with you on this week's show. And here's John in Peterborough. Hi, John.
Hi there.
What would you like to know about?
Right, years ago, well, I work in a bakery now, but years ago, we used to get a lot of cockroaches, right? And we used to stack the bread tins inside one another.
Yes.
Right? There was hardly any gap there, yet the cockroaches used to get inside. How did they manage that?
The cockroaches still got inside. What do you guys reckon?
Well, I think probably these cockroaches are, although they're quite big insects, they're quite flat dorsiventrally, so that they might have been able to crawl in through a very small hole. Alternatively, if they had laid their eggs between the tins, the eggs may have hatched and perhaps developed there.
Yeah, well, the tins we use every day, you see.
Yeah, well, they're pretty good at getting places, aren't they, cockroaches?
Yes, they're very flat and they can squeeze in.
Ah, I see.
Yeah, they're quite good at getting places they shouldn't. John, do you want a very quick go at the quiz?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, here we go. We're going to have to be really quick on this.
Okay.
Australia is under threat from yellow crazy ants. Is that fact or fiction?
Fiction.
No, I'm afraid that's true, actually. The yellow crazy ants, which can blind humans and animals because they spray acid, and they live in these super colonies we've been talking about today.
Patients don't trust a fat doctor as much as a leaner one, and I'm skinny, by the way. Fact or fiction?
Fat.
Yep, that's completely right. Yes, so that's interesting psychology about doctors.
Genetically modified silkworms can be used to make human skin. Is that fact or fiction, John?
Fiction.
Oh, I'm afraid it's actually true. Japanese scientists have been adding the gene so that silkworms can make collagen, which is what our skin is made out of.
1 out of 3, John, you're in second place. Thanks for joining us on The Naked Scientists this evening.
Sorting out the sparks from the quarks, The Naked Scientists.
The Naked Scientists, Chris and Helen, our guests this evening, William Foster and Claire Rind. We're talking about the science of insects, and time now to head back to that school. We're joining Derek, Sam, Luke and Ed Turner there at the Purse, and they're all congregating at the Museum of Zoology this evening because we've asked you to set some man traps, well, let's call them pitfall traps, and let's see what you've been catching. What have you got, guys?
Hello there once again. Welcome back to just outside the Museum of Zoology at Cambridge University. And we are here with the results of our pit traps, which Ed Turner from the Museum of Zoology and the Wildlife Trust has set up for us. So Sam and Luke are ready with their results. So why don't we have a look? Ed, would you like to instruct Sam firstly what to do with the cup, which we've just taken out of its position where it was in the garden?
Well, we've got lots of stuff in there, so we need to pour it right on the middle. We've got a white tray here, so we can see easily what the insects are we've got, and right in the middle. So things are already hopping out, actually, as we're doing that.
They are insects, aren't they, Ed?
Well, they're not really insects. They're like very primitive insects. They've got six legs, but they're not actually insects. They're called non-insect hexapods.
Well, hey, okay then. And just tell me a bit about them then. I mean, they look to me like they're maybe 3 or 4 millimetres long. Mm. They're crawling around, maybe about as big as ants, but with longer antennae. What else can you say?
Well, if we look at them, we've got some hand lenses here, which you can get from sort of shops quite easily. But they're very velvety, if you have a look at them. I think Sam's just having a look now.
What can you tell us about it, Sam? What can you see with the magnifying glass?
They're quite hairy, and they've got a sort of stripe through the middle where there's a colour change.
Okay, then. And also, what are they doing?
Well, they seem to be escaping, and occasionally they'll jump, but they won't go too far.
Okay, what's all the jumping about?
Well, actually, that gives you a clue to their name. They're actually called springtails. So what it actually is, they've got a spring at the end of their tail, which is a little structure, looks a bit like an arm, which they can straighten very fast, and it will shoot them into the air. So it's an escape response. And the reason is, these things are eaten by nearly everything. So that's why they're a bit nervous, they're a bit twitchy animals, just simply because everything's trying to munch them.
So, Luke, how about you pour some of one of your cups out there onto one of the white trays that we've got here? Okay, there we go. And Luke, where was that one from in the garden?
That was from the lawn.
Okay, so that was actually in the grass. Okay, then. So what have we got here? What can you see there, Luke?
We've got a woodlouse, which is curling up.
Okay, yeah, I think I can identify woodlouse as well. Ed, what can you say about that?
Well, so again, another interesting response to predation here, so to escape predators or things that are trying to eat it. So what we've got is a pill woodlouse. So its response is to curl up a little bit like an armadillo and protect itself from predators.
Okay, so essentially these things think we are predators, do they?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think they're in fear of their life, but of course they're not going to be harmed today. They're going to be put back afterwards.
Okay, then. Let's have a look at a third cup, then. What other one have we got here? Luke, have you got another one there?
Yes, it was in the shade, in the soil.
Okay, then. So let's pull that out and see what we've got. Okay, and what can you see there? Sam?
I think there's a young devil's coach horse.
Okay, and describe that for me.
It's sort of long and black. It's got six legs, like the average insect, but it's long.
Well, sounds like we have a real expert here, actually, Ed. What do you say?
No, he's absolutely right. It's not a young one. It's a different species. So with insects, the larvae are a bit like grubs with beetles. So it's a type of beetle. And you're quite right. It's a devil's coach horse. It's a rove beetle. And unlike most beetles, which have got these two big hardened wing cases, if you think of ladybirds, those kind of hardened wing cases. Rove beetles have actually got very tiny wing cases, and the reason is they can then move very easily between the soil or in cracks and crevices and things like that, and often hunt for smaller insects, maybe for these calemblans, actually, these springtails we've already seen.
Okay, and one thing that occurred to me as well when Luke poured out this cup that we got from the shady part of the garden was that there were really a lot of insects in there. I mean, is that what we would expect?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think what we've got here is lots of animals which are living all around the moist ground and in the mud, and so they don't like to dry out too much. This is maybe why we're getting more insects.
Okay, right. Well, I think I'm very impressed with the stuff we found here, actually. I'm very delighted as well that it all did turn out fine. So, Sam, what did you think of our harvest of insects here?
I think you definitely got a lot more insects nearer the shade.
Yeah, and I think you guys predicted that, didn't you? I can't take any credit for that. But yes, well done to you. And Luke, what do you think? How do you like the experiment we've done?
Yeah, it was good. We've got lots of insects and different types.
All right, OK. And I think hopefully you at home have heard that it's really very easy to do with a pitfall trap that we've made here. So hopefully you can do it as well and tell us at The Naked Scientists what you find. And of course, Ed, if people actually would like to get some more information on what they've found, what else can they do?
Well, they can come along to National Insect Week here in the Department of Zoology on the 24th and bring any insects that they can't identify themselves. And we've got an Ask the Entomologist section, so Ask the Insect Expert section. So you can bring along your stuff and we'll do our best to identify it for you.
And we're at the Museum of Zoology?
Museum of Zoology. Just
that's where we are. OK, at the new museum site. And perhaps you'll see the pitfall traps that we set up here. So that's fantastic. OK, well, thank you very much to Luke and Sam and to Ed for setting up the experiment. And I hope you have a very fun insect week looking for insects where you are. So we'll be back next week anyway, so until then, it's back to the studio.
We're joined now by Alan, who's in Kent. Hi, Alan.
Yes, hi there.
What's your question?
The question is this. My mother left the lid off of a jar of honey in her food cupboard. We'd never seen any ants there before, but they managed to form a line to the food cupboard from the back door overnight. And they found a jar of honey. Now, the question is, how do they do that? I mean, is it some form of radar?
How did they track down the honey then, William and Claire?
Well, it's not radar, no. I think they just have scouts who are kind of foraging around from the home colony. And when one of them does hit a nice bit of food like your mother's honey, she will then go back to the colony and recruit lots more, and then they form the trail to the honey.
Right. But the thing about this, they seem very tiny ants. Are there different species of ants?
Oh, there are, yes. There are several thousand species of ants in the world. They are probably the most important insects in the world, animals in the world, I would say, actually.
The small ones are probably pharaoh ants, and the reason I know that is because we did an experiment here on The Naked Scientist in about winter time, and we actually encouraged people to set up their own system where ants were given a honey pot, and we got an ant's nest into the studio and showed how they lay down the chemical trail to do that recruitment that William just mentioned, Alan.
Right. It seemed a miracle to me. They would do it.
Well, you know, they're very successful animals.
Exactly.
Do you want a quick go at the quiz?
I wouldn't mind.
Okay, your weight increases when you walk on the carpet. Fact or fiction?
Fiction.
Now, in fact, apparently it's true. If you put a set of weighing scales on a carpet, you're heavier, because otherwise if it's on a solid surface, the scales bend a bit and make you look lighter.
All right.
So the answer there for your rapid weight loss regime is just to weigh yourself on carpet. The European Space Agency are planning to launch a fleet of small satellites to help defend the Earth against attacks from space. Do you think that's fact or fiction?
I think that one's fiction.
Yep, that's right. No, but they are launching some microsatellites, which are 60 centimetres across, to look at near-Earth objects and see whether asteroids and things might smash into the Earth.
Plants and trees look green because they absorb green light from the sun, which they then turn into energy to help them grow. Fact or fiction?
I would say that is fact.
No, I'm afraid it's actually because we absorb the other colours and it's the green light that gets reflected back, and that's why they look green.
Thanks for joining us on the show tonight, Alan.
No problem.
That's The Naked Scientist. Chris, Helen, our guests this evening have been Claire Rind from the University of Newcastle-upon-Tyne and Dr. William Foster from the University of Cambridge. Thank you to both of you for doing a wonderful job on this evening's Naked Scientist and introducing us to the fantastic world of insects. Very quick 10 seconds from you, William. Tell us, what can people find at the Department of Zoology this week for Insect Week? Got 10,
they can find locusts flying, they can find Darwin's beetles, and they can see a plane tree being fogged for insects from the canopy.
So there you go. Come to the University of Cambridge this week for an introduction to insects. It's official. Next week, we're sending Derek to Tanzania. He's going to be making some ugali. If you want to know what that's all about, join us at 6 next week. But in the meantime, please send your questions for next week's Naked Scientists Q&A show. It's our question and answers, an hour devoted to all of your science questions and answers. So tune in for the Naked Scientists at 6 next week.
Sorting out the sparks from the quarks. The Naked Scientists. For more information, get online at nakedscientists.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.